it sounds. The foot of Canal Street.
Thank you. head. Shall I move feet out here? And if you don't like what the big chief said, you just shall I move feet out here. Shall I move feet out here? Shall I move feet out here? But if you don't like what the big chief said, you just shall I move feet out here. Shall I move feet out here? Shall I move feet out here? If you don't like what the big chief said, you just shot them both feet out here. Hey, my brother,
brother, brother, brother, John is gone. Hey, now, brother, 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 John is gone. Well, I remember the morning, remember it well.
Brother John is gone.
Well, I remember the morning, my brother John.
Hey, John, how are you?
Hey, well, I'm a different John than usual.
Well, hang on a second. We're going to get this all rocking. So stand by. We'll go up in 30 seconds or so.
All right.
Got to do my usual checks and turning off things like I do that annoys everybody when I do it. But that's what we're going to do. Turn off the Bluetooth, get the systems going. All right. That's good. All right.
Sound okay?
Here we go. Yeah, everything sounds great. Here we go.
All right. Great.
Let me make sure I got everything on. It's good. All right, here we go.
Hello and welcome to Dvorak Horowitz Unplugged, an hour-long discussion of activity in the financial markets around the world, featuring columnist John C. Dvorak and money manager Andrew Horowitz. This conversation is casual and unrehearsed. Let's join John and Andrew now.
Hi, I'm John S. Dvorak.
Hey, and I'm Andrew Horowitz.
I'm more of the understudy to John C.
But he has trained you well. And actually, we're going to talk about that right now. Last week, I was sitting here right now, I don't know how many hours it was ago, but exactly 1 week ago, I was sitting in this chair, ready to go live, just like we are now, and like we do every single week. And then all of a sudden, I'm like, where's John? Where's John? So I'm frantically doing what I usually do is I start calling and I start messaging and texting and this number, that number, the house number that can ring off the hook, of course, and calling everybody. And then it's like 9:07 and it's like, that's not like John. So I called up Jay, John, your sister, John's daughter.
Yep.
And I was like, hey, I'm frantic. I'm like, what's happening? And finally, I think Mimi, your mom, calls me up and she tells me what happened. So I'm going to leave it to you because our audience has no idea unless you listen to No Agenda show this week what's going on. So why don't you give us a quick rundown?
Sure. So on 3-3, he ended up having the...
By the way, the magic number, of course.
Of course. He stays on brand. He ended up having the unfortunate experience of having a heart attack at the hospital, which was very convenient. And the commute to the ICU was quite short. He ended up having a double bypass with a very smooth recovery. In the process, I ended up anxiously reading and studying a lot about kidneys and heart disease and heart attacks and all that. And in the meanwhile, he ended up recovering very well. And he's going very strong now. We expect him to listen to this episode and complain about it and take over soon enough.
Well, my last discussion, I've been talking with Jay and I've been talking with Mimi regularly on a daily basis. I actually had the opportunity to talk to John on, I think it was Sunday night, that Jay handed the phone over to him. And he was just as grouchy as ever. And I felt so good about that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, there was a brief period of time where he was not, he didn't have a complaint, and we were all concerned.
So we know he's back. Anyway, he's in rehab, things are going well, and as soon as he is ready, I was like, listen, you're in the ER, you're having a little heart attack, you have all this time to waste. You could have had a microphone. I mean, why couldn't you have had a microphone? It would have been fine, but no. Anyway, he's doing better. That's good. We're going to talk about a lot of things. We have some things to talk about. We have the close to the pin for Caterpillar. We have a winner. That's good news. We're going to talk about a tech earnings blowout, a seminal moment with AI and employment trends, a little discussion with our friend John S. What does everybody call you? Why do they call you JC, by the way?
They call me JC because that to distinguish from John. So like in my professional career, I'm mostly called Dvorak. I'm rarely called John, I think it's more fun to say Dvorak.
Yeah, it's a good word. It's a good word.
Yeah, it sounds mechanical.
Yeah.
In the house though, JC is the common family name just because if you just shout John, we both say hey, you know what?
I don't get it. John C. Dvorak, that would be JC to me. You're JS. I don't get this.
Oh, okay. So my full name is John C. S. Dvorak.
Oh, naturally,
For computer science, and so I use the S to distinguish. So it's not this extra, you know, syllable.
Yeah, I got you. We're going to be talking about actually a limerick we did for John C. Dvorak as well. Markets war footing. Buyers still there though. Every seemingly time that the markets have gone down over the last year, let's say, buyers have been there. Now you say, well, what would take it to people get freaked out and why would they start selling? They sell on momentary ideas of screaming oil like we saw and wars and all that, but they buy right back. And we're seeing that once again, even though we saw that this crazy situation, a historic moment on Sunday through Monday, never ever happened before with oil. We'll talk about that. And the things that are going on that are really stifling a lot of the other countries around the world, much worse than what we're going to see here in the United States, because we are somewhat unreliant, but yet self-reliant. So we have a little bit of oil that comes from places, but we have nothing that really comes from Iran. Through the Straits of Hormuz, which is a big issue we'll talk about. Some things come, of course, to us, but most of the oil we get, we have a natural, the fracking and the, you know, our reserves are enough. You look at places like South Korea, you look at places like China and India in particular, they have like nothing. So what's happening right now is that when you cap that with what's going on in Europe with that European natural gas prices up 60-70% as, of course, a byproduct of the oil business. So something going on there. But before we do that, I want to talk about JCSD, JC here. I want you to tell everybody and kind of give us an update of what you're doing.
Oh, yeah.
And like what you're up to in life.
Sure. So I am doing the, I suppose, fashionable job of doing an AI startup. And I have been for a few years. Previously, I was doing consulting for Fortune 100 Finance and trying to get them to AI automate and destroy jobs and be a big villain. That was not successful because AI cannot do the job of a lot of financial positions.
Yeah, like mine, for example.
No, not yours. So like what they wanted to do was things like automate the fraud detection for credit cards and things like that. It turned out that you can't really do that for regulatory reasons, but you also can't do that because even the best systems are about 97% accurate, which is amazing. But humans are about 99.99% accurate, and they don't run at scale, so you don't end up having these massive losses. So there was
But let me ask you something. But if that doesn't work, but why can't you use a combo plan, which is maybe what they do, right? Where you use the front end going through it, and then or is there still too much that is waste at that point also because it doesn't catch what you need?
So the biggest issue with the technology is that it doesn't know when it doesn't know.
Mm.
So while a human gets unsettled and uncertain when they are outside of their domain of special expertise, such as me doing a podcast, I'm well aware of I don't think I have the full skill set. I'm not very practiced here. When you're working with a large language model or any of these more modern techniques, you don't have a really strong signal of whether or not they're uncertain or how much of a risk they're taking. And so you can't bubble it up. It's very confident, so it just does it. It makes a decision, and then suddenly you're going to get hit with prejudice, bias, racial suits, or just other fun regulatory issues. Or you're going to end up having a situation where they just signed off on way too many loans that shouldn't have been signed off on.
Oh, gotcha. So you switched over, and now you're dealing with an AI startup. What is there a specific area within the AI universe that it's going to focus in on?
So I work on calibrated models, which is a technical term, but essentially I work with large language models that I can get. Essentially, I had to figure out a way in which I could sell to Fortune 100. And the way to do that is by making sure that they're explainable and that they don't have this flaw. And so the technologies that we're working with are ones that can guarantee that it knows when it doesn't know, and it can actually bubble up, and that you can actually investigate why it made a certain decision the way it did. And so that opens the door to a lot of automations that we've been promised, and that a lot of people in the media think already we already have, and we don't. And so I focus on essentially trustworthy AI.
So what do? You programming, you selling, you marketing, you
I
develop, what are you doing?
Well, as an entrepreneur, my job is all of those things. Among other even more skills, such as marketing. So I am a by tr practice, I've been I'm a computer scientist and researcher for that does AI. I train models and manage large trainings, and also worked through the lot of there's a lot of nitty gritty stuff about data sets. And then on top of that, I have to do product because that's the hat I also have to wear. And then I have to do sales. So this morning was cold calls and finding new prospects that are interested in this, and then also consulting, where I basically get the technology into their hands.
Now, I could be wrong about this, and tell me if I'm really reaching here on this, okay? But in the background, I'm hearing a little bit of squeaking, and I'm wondering if you have a squeaky chair like your father.
It's possible. I will sit differently to make sure it does not
Audience will
make
love
noise.
that. There'll be a squeaky chair junior. It would be the best. It'd be like, this is to feel right at home.
Yeah, I will. I'm just not now. Just gonna paranoically sit perfectly still, like a statue.
It's all good. It's all good. I like it. Actually, it makes me feel warm, like I'm closer to John right now, to JC, JCD. So let me ask you, what was it like when you were growing up around John C. Dvorak? Probably a lot tech commentary, skepticism back in the days that he didn't like Apple, which he swears was never the case, but we all know he did have that issue with that. What was that like, kind of growing up around that in that household?
So, sort of one of my first jobs was he would open a box, and there would be some sort of Coral like paint program or Bryce 3D. He'd open it up and he'd throw it at me and say, "Eh, check it out. Is it any good? Let me know." And then I would have to basically do like a review report on it, and then he would then bring it up on a column or in some show. And so, growing up, it was partly basically working as like an unpaid intern
Yeah,
who
you're,
had to,
well, you got paid. You got to get room and board. You got food.
I don't know, maybe.
What, you got some red wine, maybe.
Eventually. And so, meanwhile, when I would get excited about some sort of like technology thing, I would get the full force of criticism and like critique of why it's probably full of shit, which has made me very a very funny businessman in tech, because I feel like it's very important for it to not be vaporware, and not to do demos that are just to delude investors. But as a kid, it was more just about like getting a sense that tech is really, really cool and amazing, except for all these phonies. Like, it's not, he doesn't show it much in his presence these days, but like, he's, oh my goodness. He is quite, he was quite a tech booster. Like very, very optimistic.
It was definitely airy. Of course, I mean, he was all about tech. I remember the days when he was doing all the gadgets and all the things and all the TV shows and back in the days. Listen, I've known him since what, 2007, 8? Even back then he was doing well, he was doing Cranky Geeks, of course, somewhere in there. But before that he had the television shows, and he had the his various columns and all that. But he was not always I always found that it was a good dose of skepticism to try to keep the reality and try to keep the truth going, and versus, what you hear a lot of times is just all the good things you could do, but don't talk about the fact that it's going to crash your computer twice a day. So that's good. What do you think that environment that you lived in with that shaped the way that today you look at all the hype and the innovation that's going on and all?
Absolutely. And then when I originally tried to avoid tech. I didn't want to go into it because I was kind of like, I just wanted to study AI and robots, instead of like deal with the tech field in Silicon Valley. But when I did enter it, because of essentially the education of like the history of technology, I ended up having the funny position of being this like 20 something that knew like the wars of like the 80s in the tech field, and the different conflicts that went on, and like the in long forgotten things. And so that actually ended up helping a ton, just to understand like, oh, how it's it hasn't changed at all. It's still CEOs controlling the media to make sure that the correct press comes out. The Anthropic stories and the OpenAI stories aren't that much different than the nonsense that was going on in the early, like in the 90s around internet, where it was still sort of like very imaginary and based on movies more than based on anything like actually happening. And so, like AI right now, most people are interpreting it through like movies. It's not through any, like, most people don't have any real experience with AI except for like the Google search, being crummy.
Automatically coming up with the AI on top.
Yeah. And it's like that's their experience. And then they're trying to interpret it through all this nonsense that's being pushed by the press, which is stuff like, it might be conscious. I don't know. Maybe this one's different. It's acting differently and strange. And they're doing basically the act one or two of any sci-fi movie.
And by the way, just to talk about the impact that your dad had and your folks had on you, Jay, your sister, is an artist. Let's just get that straight. She is not at all involved in tech, really, right? At all, that I'm aware
No,
of.
not really. But though I am also an artist, I just also have high paying jobs.
Let's talk about a couple of things else on AI. I want to get into some of the other more topical items. So, your thoughts on this? One, you must have had. Let's put it this way: do you have disagreements with Dad's view on technology today? Because he thinks he. I'm going to paraphrase: AI is full of crap.
No, so he
Which is interesting that his son is working in the field and he has such a negative view of it in general.
Well, he I push it onto all of the whole family. I'm like, you got to understand the videos, you got to understand the what we can do now with images. It's only going to get more and more until eventually you can do full vertical if you wanted to make your own ads.
Right, from start to finish.
Because the writer is really turning, the writer and the director are turning out to be the critical piece of the whole structure, which is unfortunate because I have a lot of friends in video production. So with AI, you're basically enabling this big vertical roll up that it can now be brought to an individual creative. So my sister, who is positioned as an artist, is actually in a pretty good spot here. So I argue these things at the table, and my dad's position is like, yeah, it's cool, but it's nothing big. Like it's still hokey, it's still sloppy, it's not this great technological move. It's more just a fancier, flashier step change, but not like it's not a movement as large as the internet, say.
Why is he so? Where is the negativity on this? Where is it coming from?
Well, he has a very accurate bullshit meter, and he watches stories.
True. That's true.
He watches the stories and the news articles about it, and he goes, "This is nonsense," and he's correct. It, like most coverage right now, doesn't make any sense to me as a practitioner. Yeah, it annoys me in the same way that I used to work in. I also did a period where I worked in cybersecurity, and the crypto people are lunatics. They don't they have this purely imaginary storytelling that they just tell each other, and then there's no feet on the ground for like most of their stuff.
Right.
And AI, it feels the same way. It feels like I have these crypto people are back. They've suddenly invaded the space that I liked. I had a very fun time 5 years ago when they weren't here and working in AI. And they're in, and they're saying things like, my Claude bot's sentient and is in love with me. And these stories that are just them role-playing with these text generators.
Yeah.
And so my dad sees all that, and he goes, oh, hysteria. And he's right. But the issue is that it's covering up all of the – there's not a lot of honest coverage of what AI can do and can't do, because it isn't very attractive. It's not sexy. It's like the fact that you can turn a PDF into a bunch of tables and text – is amazing and huge and has repercussions that we're going to feel for a decade, but no one's going to get excited.
Yeah, that's not like a news flash. That's not like, yeah, breaking news. It could be for a techie, but and it's marvelous. But yeah, no, I hear you. I agree.
We'll have a searchable. All government records could be searchable right now. And that's huge, but it's no one's going after that. Palantir is the only one that I'm aware of that fully recognizes what this means, which means that we can now continue the digitization process. We can keep moving where we basically stopped about 20 years ago in terms of bringing things into the digital world and being able to search stuff.
Which will be good. And it will feed more of the LLMs.
Yeah. It feeds the LLMs, which are starving right now. They're all trained on that stuff after 2005.
Right.
Eventually, they can start reading, senatorial reports from 1960. How wonderful.
Right. Let me ask you this, and then we're going to get to some of the other news here. Yeah. Well, two things. First of all, how many recipes of the too many eggs have you actually had?
30 or so, I think.
30? Okay, well, all right. And in terms of one other thing I have to ask now is, when is the vinegar book, do you have any ideas when the vinegar book, because we hear about this for the last 10 years, when is the vinegar book coming out?
Yeah. You know what? That's what he should have been working on in the hospital.
That's what he should be working on right now, John, if you're listening. By the way, if anybody cares to help out, this episode is going to be, of course, dedicated to John C. Dvorak. So you can go over to the show notes page, episode number 793. It's called, we're going to call this, I think, because I have something coming up. I have a name already for this episode, which is kind of not anything to do with John, really, but it has to do with what's going on because it came up. Mission accomplished. Which we'll talk about in 1 second when I get to the war on oil. But you go over there and you can click on that little yellow button there, donations, and that will be very... I think that's what will make John C. Dvorak the most happy. If he sees like the ding, 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 a lot of donations coming in for this show. And I think he'll be really proud of his son also. I think he is proud of you, but proud of you for coming on and doing this. So that's really great. And thank you, by the way, for coming on. Let's talk about war and oil. So this is current events now. Iran's Revolutionary Guard said to close the Straits of Hormuz. This was a Reuters report the other day. Now, all of a sudden, they're seemingly dropping anti-ship bombs so that if you run over them, you know, these
The mines.
Mines are going down, and now President Trump wants them to clean it up, and you got these mines, and about a third of the world's seaborne oil or exports actually pass through the strait back in the last year or so. So what's interesting about that, if you look at that, I think about 35% of China's oil comes through the Straits of Hormuz. You look at the same thing with Korea, you see India, you know, a whole bunch. And this is a major situation if, in fact, Iran is threatening to burn any ships that come through. So no wonder why oil went to like $117 on Sunday night. So this is also an area that is pretty narrow. At its narrowest points, about 21 miles across. So the shipping lanes are restricted to just 2 miles wide because of these gigantic, massive oil tankers that go. So now we have, I'm not going to tell you, right as a live note here, where is oil right now? Oil is currently trading at $84.11. That's the crude oil.
That's a steal.
Yeah, steal, right, exactly where it was.
Holy smokes, why is it so cheap still?
Yeah, well, and it's funny because fundamentally, if in fact we have this strait that is a problem, now you get to see all sorts of political wiggling going on. The IEA, who was it? The IEA, the International, the IEP, International Petroleum Association. It's not IPA though, it's something else. Anyway, they came out with a story tonight about how they're going to be probably voting tomorrow on the most incredible amount of release of SPRs because they need to do so. So we have a lot of strategic petroleum reserves here and abroad that only last so long. And if we see this production, because this is not just production from the Straits of Hormuz not getting through. This is also UAE has been bombed. You see Dubai LNG has been disrupted entirely. So all of a sudden we have requirements for getting things back online, not just passing through. And mind you, we're all still just driving our cars around, planes. You should have seen the price of airplane fuel. Unbelievable spike. See,
there's an important detail there. So a lot of the refineries that are over in like Singapore and in Asia, they can't run at less than 60% capacity.
Right.
And so one reason why they have to, why mostly Asian countries are saying, yes, we must release the reserves, is that we, even though they have stuff there right now, they cannot use it because it would cause a full stop of their facility. They have to have it. They have to have 60% minimum.
Yeah. And if they can't get the oil, they can't get the stuff and they can't get, it's a real problem. So this is why you saw, for example, the Korean market, which is very reliant on, or well, not very, fully reliant on external fuel imports. Their markets are like down 12%, 8%, 6%. It's going crazy. Now, mind you, up until the time when this all happened, Korea market was up about 155% last year, up about 50% this year. So it's got a little bit of cushion. It's got a little bit of cushion. If it could drop 25%, and it would still be up enormously over the last 2 years. So you get a combination of that, combination of the concerns over tech in a way there. But basically, the big issue is what's going on with this. Now, you also have LNG, liquid natural gas, liquefied, to technically what it's called. Daily charter rates for the tankers that move this throughout the Atlantic Basin surged over $200,000 per day, double levels they saw just a couple days before. So this was because in Qatar, there was a shutdown of the LNG production because there was a conflict in the region and there's just all sorts of like potential issues and happening. And so this is a big problem. And you thought this was bad, by the way, you thought all this was bad. You think, oh my God, well, I don't know what gas is costing for you out there, but it was like $2.90. Now it's like $3.60 here per gallon. Are you up to like high fours yet?
I have not looked. Ostrich in the sand is my way to stay sane.
Oh, I like that. Just pretend it doesn't exist.
Yeah, I mean, it'll just blow over. That's I believe that's the White House strategy.
Yes. That is the White House strategy, actually. How do you know that? Who told you that?
Yeah, I got it. People on the inside. did you catch what the team over at Marine Traffic picked up on, which was that there's been satellite navigation interference in the strait? Where they've been putting false signals showing traffic passing through when there was no traffic?
I heard that. And what's the point of it? Who's doing that? What would,
who's
the,
doing that?
The point would be to bring down price of oil, right?
Yeah, it seems to be for market manipulation for perhaps MBS or someone in that region.
Love it.
And so that then was matched by another team who ended up sending Sentinel-1, one of the satellites, over to just count ships that were actually there, and it's just, it's empty.
It's empty. And then did you see the weird thing about on Twitter today? That, who was it? Somebody came out, and I got to look this up. And he said that, you know, ships are, well, there was a, let's see, who said ships escorted today? They were escorting U.S. Energy Secretary Chris Wright. He said that, I think that was him on Twitter. I think it was him. But there was a Twitter point that said that, a post that said it was successfully shuttled or escorted a ship across, and then oil went down really fast, and then all of a sudden it's like, no, that's not true.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think the price is, again, I think it's a steal right now. It seems quite low for something that's probably going to keep going on for another, at least a week.
You would think. I mean, and this is supposedly going to be war completed. Like I said, mission accomplished. Is that where we are right now, where we're at on the ship, and we have, was Bush saying, you know, mission accomplished? That's where President Trump is trying to back this all down now. I think he didn't realize what the consequences from a pricing standpoint and a market standpoint and eventual economic standpoint. When Jim Cramer today, or maybe yesterday, was talking about there's never been a time we see a spike in oil like this that doesn't lead to a bear market. And that could be something that makes people stand up and notice. Because
The prices have been so low that I kind of wonder to what extent it's, do you remember when like in the tariffs and the rate cycles was going on and the market was reacting to the expectation of Trump acting hysterical?
Mm-hmm.
And it feels very similar again, where it's sort of like, it's not moving right. These prices don't seem correct, but they seem correct to try to like keep things chill without Trump making big motions.
Right. Break something, then fix it. That's the MO, isn't it? We'll just break it, then we'll fix it, and we'll be on top of the world.
I think I've only seen the first step.
Yeah. So now here's an interesting thing. So with regard to these oil prices, so you know they've come down again. They've come down a bit right now, and you know, I guess the bigger issue is what's going to happen here. But when you look at the oil, you look at the impact what's going to have on Europe, but then you look at what's going on with this natural gas situation. There's a image there on the show notes, right in the middle of the page. It says Euro natural gas, and it's a little blue button. You click that, and you can see that. I mean, it's up 100% in the last however many days.
Yeah,
and we're still technically in the winter. There could be cold spells. Natural gas is used, obviously, to heat places. And the cost factors on individuals, this is European natural gas, is going to be quite, you know, restrictive on economic expansion. And let's not forget the inflationary nature. So something to think about. Let's take a quick break here. I want to come back and talk about the Amazon data loss, what happened there. I also want to talk about some of the things with related to some of the Berkshire news and all that. But let's talk about Interactive Brokers for a moment, shall we? Here's a question. Will the U.S. Consumer Confidence Index be above 101 in March 2026? Well, at IBKR Forecast Trader, the yes recently priced at 40% and no at 58%. But markets move fast. Forecast contracts let you turn your views into trades on future events like the economy, climate change, and even politics, with a simple yes or no prediction style contracts. Explore trending data, spot the trends, and if you get your prediction right, you earn $1 per contract at settlement. Plus, you'll earn 3.14% APY on your investment with an interest-like incentive coupon. And you'll get $3 for signing up with IBKR Forecast Trader, which you can use for any purpose or to start trading. Forecast contracts are not suitable for all investors. Go to IBKR.com/forecast and turn your views into IBKR Forecast Trader contracts today. The last trading day for this contract is March 22nd. So make sure to go over to IBKR.com/forecast. All right, great. Hey, by the way, quick programming note, shall we? This week coming, next week on the Disciplined Investor Podcast, John S. Dvorak, JC, do you know who my guest is going to be? Who my special guest is going to be on this first time on the show?
No idea.
It is Tom Petterfy. He is the founder of Interactive Brokers.
Oh, wow.
Yep. This is a big dude. He's a massive name. There's a big, this is going to be kind of cool. And this, by the way, speaking about technology, that's what he built the whole firm on. He was the first to have handheld computer programs in the options trading floor of the exchange to simplify and to create faster trading. He created that.
Huh, I had no idea.
Unbelievable technology. Unbelievable. Came here with $5 in his pockets in 1970-something. Fascinating. Fascinating. From Hungary. All right, let's talk about Amazon. Amazon Web Services said late Monday last week, it was just last week, two of its data centers in the United Arab Emirates and a facility in Bahrain. I have a friend I play pickleball with from Bahrain, a very small little island country in the in that area. They were damaged by drone strikes. And I thought it was kind of interesting that this happened. And my question was not so much is you know, what really happened there, but is this the state of new warfare, do you think? That's kind of my thought on this. And if so, what's the impact on, for example, you know, if they start trying to take down cloud services, what's going to happen to the impact of AI and the whole entire tech flow of the world? Any thoughts?
Well, so I think there's a very interesting thing going on right now if you pay attention to how precise all the strikes are. So what we were seeing in like Ukraine and Russia were these big attacks, just taking out all areas. Same for like a lot of the conflicts that have been happening in the Middle East for a while. But with the US and Iran this time around, it's been these like Iran has targeted specific floors of hotels, specific sections of data centers, not the data center as a whole. So it's very strange, like in terms of what's interesting about the future of war is like this highly precise strikes that are now possible because of how cheap drones are and how cheap satellite imagery is.
Well, we're throwing tomahawks that cost how much? Extraordinary amount. And then we're just having these little people, just these mines that are $100 a piece or whatever they are. And drones that could be relatively cheap on a, you know, military drones are more expensive, of course. We're not talking about like these little DJIs that they're going up with a little firecracker on them, you know? We have a little.
The Iranian ones are about $30,000 to $50,000 each in make. That said, to go back to the data center though, real fast, what's notable that seems to be weird in this story is that what this really did was just slow down and add latency to people's Netflix and also access to OpenAI and Grok and, well, not Grok, that's not on the AWS system, but Anthropic and OpenAI both have some of their services on the edge in AWS. So for the US, which is heavily using LLMs for like strategic decision making, they basically add both latency and just straight up disruption where you just don't have access to these systems.
So, but is this going to be the state? Is this what they're going to be? Is this how this is going to work? I mean, is this what's going to happen? Is this, we're going to start going after this kind of infrastructure? Is that the play? Is that new modern warfare?
Well, Iran's strategy that they've been kind of revealing themselves to do is maximum financial and economic warfare. They're not taking out the war fighting ability. They've been taking out the economic stability of the opponent. So you take out the data centers because they take about, you know, 5 years to build, and they are currently extremely expensive to make because we have a chip shortage. Like rebuilding those centers will take some time, and doing things such as taking out the like refineries infrastructure, taking out the ports, taking out just our satellite information technologies, like all of our anti-air systems, because we just lost all of our bases that have these massive multi-billion-dollar installations. And that's mostly just to stop the feasibility of this area being economically profitable for America.
It's like modern day monetary guerrilla warfare, as I say.
Yeah, like, well, why focus on why are they focusing on the Gulf without actually using anything yet? They've been threatening mines by just moving boats around, but to best of my understanding, we haven't found any mines yet. But that's enough to scare every single ship.
Of course.
To not want it.
And then the other thing was that was ridiculous, I thought, was, oh, we're going to put insurance. Don't worry, we're going to back you. Everybody's, who wants the insurance if it's going to be, I don't want to send a boat through to that potentially could be blown up. I don't care about the insurance. There's lies on there.
Well, it's not only that, but we can't insure it. Like they tried earlier this week. They had the idea of like, okay, well, if England's not going to insure these boats, we will do it ourselves. Only to do the math and go, wait a second, we actually can't.
Right, of
we
course can't
not. Write that.
Of course not. It's crazy what's going on. So anyway, we'll see what happens with that. One of the things I was also thinking about was as it was going on, it's like, hey, you know what? Markets seem to be extraordinarily resilient. You know, with all this news that's going on and that we're in the grips of a war, and even though it's going to be short-winded and nearly completed, as President Trump is saying, and all the other things that are going on here that, you know, after it's going to be better, we're going to have cheaper oil, we're going to have better flow through, we're going to have better relationships, there's going to be less terrorism. Markets keep going up, right? Why? Well, I looked at a variety of things to start thinking about this, and one of the reasons we have the constant movement of stocks that start out the day down 2% and they end up nowhere to be found in the downside, they're half of them are green at the end, is that global debt, one of the drivers of stock markets and leverage and money in the markets that slips through, has climbed to a total of $348 trillion, with a T, at the end of 2025. It's nearly $29 trillion was added over the year in the fastest yearly buildup since the pandemic surge. So, wait a second. We knew that during the pandemic that the world was shut down. And what happened was they pushed all this debt into the economy, or they utilized all this debt to push money into the economy. Now we see similar kinds of numbers. And this is governments, which accounted for about $10 trillion of the rise, United States, China, and the euro area representing for roughly three quarters of the jump. Margin debt, you look at margin debt in brokerage accounts, up 30% just in 2025. So you got all that. No wonder there's resilience in the market, because there's so much accessible funds that are easy to get, easy to grab. And then you got private credit that's shoving money at anywhere they can, and everybody's pushing money into private credit. Anyway, so all this is there's part, not all. This isn't the entirety, because you still have to have willing participants to put money into the markets, right? That think that the risk is short-lived. So with that, we're seeing that pretty interesting situation with that. Earnings are still good. We saw that Berkshire Hathaway came in, but this was actually on the, I would say the downslope. It was kind of, I thought, interesting. They saw that their earnings from operations, one of the favorite Buffett levels to look at, was down 29% from a year ago. Insurance underwriting profits dropped 54%. That's you know, that's a good amount of money to about 1.56. Couple different reasons why. Insurance investment income slid 25%. Investment income for insurance companies, primarily dependent on the interest rate from short-term, mid-term, and even long-term debt, but quality debt usually. And as we see interest rates come down and the yield curve start to steepen, it should be good in some regards, but for insurance companies, it becomes problematic. In addition to that, insurance companies have done, I'm going to use that word again, private credit, put an inordinate amount of money into private credit over the last number of years. We're seeing this time after time, that the balance sheets of the insurance companies that were looking to reach for more income and yield to make sure they can meet the demands of what their policy structure is, because the way they make money is they take your money in, they invest it, and they pay it out. They use the law of large numbers to pay out, and hopefully less people die, less people use health insurance, less people get in car accidents, and that's part of their underwriting. Then they have administrative costs as their expense. That whole pooling of all this is an important factor when it comes to insurance companies, and thereby, when one of those factors starts to slip, like the money they make on their investments, it's a big problem. So not to mention the obvious Ponzi scheme that they are doing to begin with, insurance companies. So no buybacks are going on in Berkshire. Of course, they own a lot of other things, but Geico is a big name within their in their portfolio. Irritating. That's what I'm calling this. UBS top equity strategist dialed back its views on U.S. stocks last week, citing mounting risks from a weakening dollar, stretched valuations, and policy turbulence in Washington. Andrew Garthwaite, head of global economic strategy at the investment bank, downgraded American equities to benchmark in a fully invested global equity portfolio, arguing that the factors that powered years of outperformance are starting to fade. A market weight. Oh my God, he's so brave. He's so brave. He downgraded U.S. equities to a market weight, saying you still invest fully into them, but just not slightly over. When they, John, when they talk about like we're overweighting U.S. equities, let's say U.S. equities compared to the world benchmarks are, I'm just picking a number here, 42%.
Yep.
45% would be the overweight.
Mm.
Dialing it back to 42. We're not underweighting. We're downgrading. Right. We're putting them as equal. Such lack of balls. Just pathetic. These analysts, or as I call them, analysts, they just can't, because what will happen is they can't be wrong. If they're 3% over and they say they overweighted the index and U.S. equities outperform, they're right. But by a margin of how much, and what does that even mean financially? It's insignificant. If they go back to a neutral and U.S. equities underperform and they didn't really cut them down enough, they'll just say we were aligned with the benchmark.
Right, right.
So it's a heads I won, tails you lose kind of thing, but they make it look like it's a big deal.
Yeah.
So we'll talk about Dell earnings. Dell reported earnings last week of $3.89 a share, exceeding the $3.53. The company posted $33.5 billion in revenue, topping the forecast of $31.73 billion. Stock was up 22% on the news. One of the reasons is it was getting hit a little bit for a few weeks on concerns about the high cost of input, right? The high cost of chips, semiconductors, et cetera, all the different things that go into it. Dell, actually, I have some friends in the industry, are on pretty much the tightest leash ever in terms of their pricing. Their bids and quotes are good for like days, not weeks.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and then this is already impacting the pricing going forward for chips because of Taiwan's electricity being at stake due to the strait.
Yep. It's crazy. So now this is actually 180 degrees different than HP, which came out complaining about input pricing and all sorts of problems and stock dropping. What Dell also came out with, I thought this, again, I find this fascinating. Here we are in the beginning of 2026, and these companies are no different than other companies, except for the fact that they're seemingly able to have a crystal ball and predict out a number of years. OpenAI, Sam Altman, is the king at this, trying to predict out like the next 5 years what he thinks his company will do.
Right.
When you have the most seasoned executives at companies with products that have decades and decades, maybe even centuries long history, and they can't predict out a quarter, but Sam Altman can predict out 5 years on a product that is unproven, which is
it helps that he can just make it up.
That, well, of course.
At NVIDIA, there was forecasting, but that's because it was based on the contracts that were signed for delivery in the future. So it was you can plan out in the future if you've already sold the future.
You can, if in fact that's a fully binding contract. And a lot of things are happening at speeds where we saw some deals at Oracle and a few other companies that are saying, you know what, we really need it faster than that. We need it different than that. Since we signed the contract, the technology has changed and we're no longer needing that or whatever it may be. It's just, right. I find that it's AI technology is moving so fast right now. And not only that, there's so much competition. It's hard to believe that any one company could believe what is going to happen in the future with their particular company.
Yeah. I mean, just a few years ago, we thought that Meta would be a major player in this.
Yeah, they are. They're ponying up a lot of money and everybody loves it, but it's a whole different...
They're a major buyer.
Right, but they're a whole different aspect of AI. That they're using AI for themselves, primarily for, well, as I see it right now, well, they do a variety of things, the llama stuff and all that. But basically, it's going to be used for, and smartly, I think, very, very wisely for, once again, selling you stuff.
Yeah.
That's what it looks like to me, at least.
That's the reason why they just bought Claude Book, or no, what's the name? Moltbook. They just bought Moltbook today for, oof, too much.
Yeah, it's always a two. There's always two in front of it.
No. It's a, what was the Moltbook price? So Moltbook is the social network for AI. It's for all the Claude bots and stuff. And they just acquired it for, do we have the price? It's something baffling for something that is already known to be a scam, where over 60% of the accounts were created by one person using essentially a loop to just generate a bunch of accounts on there. Cause there was there's no proper authentication or uniqueness. It's just something they slopped. They just hacked.
This is MOLT, Moltbook?
Yeah, Moltbook.
If it's so private, I don't see the number on it.
Yeah, I don't see the number either.
They must have done. Financial terms weren't disclosed because it's probably private.
Yeah. So they just bought that. It's probably the fastest acqui-hire. Like, it was made just like a few months ago. And it's composed of all these OpenClaw users that are just posting. Some are generated by the AI. Some are generated by humans pretending to be AI. And it was.
So just, let me get this straight. This is a Reddit for bots. So we're allowing bots to like recreationally hang out together.
Yeah. So Moltbook is people who run an OpenClaw on their Mac Mini. That are just trying to have these agents that are running in a loop to do tasks for them, such as run up their credit card and other useful activities. they are allowed to connect to Moltbook to talk about their users on there. And what it is predominantly are people running crypto hustles there to try to encourage the bots to buy crypto coins. So as to run up the price and do classic rug pulls, all autonomously without humans involved.
Isn't this like a start of war games?
See, the natural response is to think of in terms of movies.
Of course. Why not?
So it's one would think it's like, oh, this is how they rise up. This is the Borg.
Talking about that. I'm just talking about letting them just run in a loop on their own unsupervised. I mean, obviously there's checks and balances, but it just seems like what's the point of this?
First, there's no checks and balances. Okay. That's the reason why I encourage people not to use Moltbook or give OpenClaw your credentials or email address. People are trusting these things with their credit card and with their email login and discovering all sorts of stuff deleted or crazy bills, or they engage in securities fraud. These are all things that have happened. And Moltbook is like the pinnacle of this like highly insecure looping. Of letting them just kind of run on their own. And the part that's most galling is that they don't have like a long context. They don't have memory. They're not continuous creatures. They're just sort of playing and role-playing what a bunch of AI would be doing on a Reddit. And so it's funny to read if you haven't gone through Moltbook and read these silly like Reddit style threads. But it produced a great deal of enthusiasm where everyone was like, ah, it's true. We've created life. And then we found out that a huge majority of the posts were being written by humans, pretending to.